Hi, this is Arnie Arneson, and this is the Monday edition of The Attitude with Arnie Arneson and producers Dave Scott and Stephanie Collins. Of course, because it's Rethink the Week Monday, we're recording on Friday morning. So before we begin our lineup of great talkers, let me do a quote from Fannie Willis from the hearing of, I guess it was Thursday. And I just thought this is almost a scripted line. Here's Fannie. Let's go on and have a conversation. I don't need anything from a man. A man is not a plan. A man is a companion. I don't need anybody to foot my bills. The only man who has foot my bills completely is my daddy. And I'm listening to this and I'm going, oh my God, it sounds like a line from Barbie the movie. And on top of that, she's even wearing pink. I was just like, whoa. Anyway, I just thought we needed to sort of capture that line. It almost deserves a billboard. Anyway, joining us right now are a great group of Rethink talkers. We have Stephen Pimpare, a senior fellow at the Carsey School of Public Policy at the University of New Hampshire, author of four books. His most recent book has won the award from the American Political Science Association, The book is Politics for Social Workers, A Practical Guide to Effecting Change. Welcome back to the program, Mr. Pimpare.
Thank you, Arnie. Good to be here.
Dave Leventhal is also joining us. He leads Raw Stories Newsroom as editor-in-chief and oversees its investigations and enterprise reporting. He's based in Washington, D.C. He previously worked as deputy editor and senior Washington correspondent for Insider. He's also worked as an editor-reporter for the Center for Public Integrity, Politico, Open Secrets, the Dallas Morning News, and, of course, when I first met him, the Eagle Tribune. Welcome back to the program, Dave.
It's great to be back with you, Arnie.
And finalmente, Lincoln Mitchell, who teaches political science and public policy at Columbia University. He's the author of eight books, and his writings have appeared at CNN, Reuters, The New York Times, NBC, The San Francisco Examiner. And if you want more of Lincoln's work, you can subscribe to his Substack, Kibitzing with Lincoln. Welcome back to the program, Mr. Mitchell.
Always good to be here, Arnie.
So as we go to tape, literally, which is Friday morning, the announcement has come that Putin's most vociferous critic, Navalny, is found dead. And as I pointed out, this seems eerily familiar as to something that relates to Donald Trump. And what I wrote was, Trump team argued assassination of rivals is covered by presidential immunity. Obviously, he's looking at Putin and saying, whatever Putin can do is exactly what I want to be able to do. So let me start with you, Lincoln, because you really mentioned that this was something that was sort of near and dear to your heart because of what the Republicans are doing, because now they've become the cult of Putin. And at the same time, what you see going on with Navalny, well, that's exactly what the Trump team argued. You know, that would be legitimate. That would be something that he was above the law because he is the law. And that's exactly how Putin runs Russia.
That is exactly right. But it's also important to understand the deep, twisted mirror world logic of the Republican Party. So for those who don't follow Russian politics that closely, and I'll be brief here, Navalny has for years been the leading critic and opponent, most prominent of Vladimir Putin and the Russian regime. And the Russian regime has responded with an attempt to poison him, with assaults on him, with imprisoning him, and ultimately, I think we should say, killing him. We want to be careful here when we say Navalny has died in prison. That suggests a passive voice. A more accurate description would be to use the active voice. Navalny was killed in prison by the Russian state led by Vladimir Putin. Now, this is precisely what Trump is saying. Hey, I'm the president. Yeah, I can kill my opponents if I want to, just like Putin. However, in Republican world, what they are saying is Biden is Putin because Biden wants to imprison his opponents just like Putin. Now, that is, to use a technical term, one that we can say on the radio, nonsense. But it is something that they believe. It is also, or at least that they're saying, who knows what they believe, and frankly, I don't care. It is also very important to keep in mind that this is occurring as the Republican Party is even more actively than in the past embracing a position of, let's be clear here, doing the work of Vladimir Putin.
Yes.
What the Republican Party, is doing in Congress right now is to help the Russian war effort against Ukraine. And this is occurring as the leading opponent of the Russian regime has been killed in prison 40 miles north of the Arctic Circle. And if the idea of being in a Russian prison 40 miles north of the Arctic Circle doesn't literally and figuratively chill you to the core, I don't know what will. Alexei Navalny, I love Hashalem.
So Dave Leventhal, We know that if you want to quote the great Marjorie Taylor Greene, she has suggested, for example, that giving aid to Ukraine puts America last and means we're ignoring our own people's problems. I mean, I just listen to the language that she's using. In a lot of ways, it's mirroring some of the things that you just heard from Lincoln. Because as I was coming on the air with you guys, I was watching television. Kamala Harris was in Munich, and she introduced Navalny's widow. Okay, she had Navalny's widow there. Do we need to explain this to the American people that Donald Trump wants the right to assassinate someone? And yet the suggestion that you heard from Lincoln is he's able to once again, whatever, he mirrors the opposite onto whoever is his opposition. I mean, Donald Trump. And now to suggest that Biden is sort of a version of Putin is just absolutely terrifying, because how do you know what's up and what's down? And what kind of form of explanation do you give to the American people to explain what Donald Trump is doing and how devastating it is? Because Donald Trump has become an accomplice to both Xi and Putin, frankly. You know, they couldn't accomplish as much from the outside as Trump is rotting from the inside.
Well, we talk about America first as a concept, and of course it is, and one that not quite half of all Americans subscribe to some level, well, one extent or another. But really, when we're talking about it, we're talking about Donald Trump first, and many of the policies, including the one that you just offered up from Marjorie Taylor Greene, is echoing what Donald Trump himself aspires to, which is that whatever our domestic policy is, whatever our foreign policy is, it's really about a policy that's going to help Donald Trump consolidate power and get back into power. And I think the most notable thing that has happened over the past several days, in addition to what just happened in Russia, was when Donald Trump, at a campaign event, stood up and basically offered an invitation to Russia to attack a NATO member who, in Donald Trump's estimation, was not paying enough money to be part of the alliance. And that's something that, of course, immediately was decried as tantamount to treason or un-American in the words of Joe Biden. But this is the level of discourse that we're having right now. And this is the aspiration that Donald Trump is offering up to the American public in a way that is 100% completely self-serving for Donald Trump, with sort of the fig leaf of, well, this is a good thing for America, we'll keep America first. Well, now it's great for Donald Trump because it allows him to have political rhetoric that, at least in part, the point is that it allows him to have political rhetoric that resonates with a certain population. But this is a little off topic, but related, so stick with me for 20 seconds here. I was walking down Wisconsin Avenue in Washington, D.C. the other day, and I walked by the Russian embassy. And which is there, a giant brutalistic building behind a very large fence in Washington, D.C. And what is the name of the one block that is in front of the Russian embassy on Wisconsin Avenue? It got a special name about 6 years ago, and it's Boris Nemtsov Plaza. Well, who's he? He was the former deputy prime minister of Russia who became a major opposition activist, a vocal critic of Putin. And he was shot dead on a bridge 3 years ago. God. So when I heard the news that yet another Vladimir Putin critic had died under unclear circumstances, the circumstances of which we all know, it was just a reminder that this is not a new thing. This is just a standard mode of operation for Putin, for Russia. So when you hear Marjorie Taylor Greene or you hear Donald Trump talk about Russia or Vladimir Putin in glowing terms or terms that may, again, be self-serving, we have to remind ourselves of history that is not long at all, and things that have happened very, very recently of the same exact sort.
So, Stephen, on my Facebook page, I actually discussed this with Bill Curry on Friday, but it's worthy of discussion again. And again, and I was not aware of Navalny because it was earlier than this, but nothing surprises me. We knew that Navalny was a dead man walking. Everyone knew it. The question was, when was he going to be basically killed, murdered, expire, whatever, in Siberia? But I want to connect this to another region in the world, which is Israel. And I wrote this on my Facebook page. Bibi is a Trump accomplice. Together, their inhumanity is doing more damage than Xi or Putin could ever have accomplished. Bibi is killing Palestinians and destroying Israel's search for safety and security. And Trump is prepared to offer up America to the highest bidder, be it a Putin, a Musk, or Leonard Leo and his billionaire network. And I really feel like at this point in time, Bibi and Trump together are doing so much in the way of undermining anything that will bring any form of stabilization. And they're doing it in such both predictable and creative ways. And it will ultimately, in the end, I think, bear horrible fruit for Joe Biden in November, unless we figure out how to sort of either weave a narrative or begin to stop the kind of inhumanity that we're seeing. And we're seeing it in places like Ukraine, and we're seeing it in places like Gaza.
So let me see if I can do some of that work of shifting the narrative a little bit by picking up on something that Lincoln observed. And I've seen this on social media this morning. Prominent members of the right, as Lincoln said, identifying Biden as Putin in this scenario, right?
Yes,
it is
yes.
Trump who is the political enemy, and the goal of all of his prosecutions is to incarcerate him and eventually kill him so that he is unable to function as a political opponent. I think it is worth taking a moment, right, to understand why they are trying to do that, because they need an explanation. So if you will bear with me, just as we speak on Friday, the 16th of February, we have this week a date set for an election fraud and bribery case set for March 25th. This is the Stormy Daniels case. As we speak, the United States Supreme Court is in conference, likely discussing two things. One is the movement by Colorado to disqualify Trump from the presidential ballot, having concluded that he engaged in insurrection, and a claim by Trump that he is immune from prosecution, a reference that was made earlier, right? If the court rejects that claim, the DC federal case for election interference will move forward. Meanwhile, there is a Georgia trial in place for conspiracy to commit election fraud. And by the time that folks hear this, we are likely to hear a decision from New York Judge Engoron, the penalty for the business fraud and tax evasion of the Trump organization, which could result in a $370 million penalty and dissolve Trump businesses. Meanwhile, I think just this week, too, a mandate was issued in the E. Jean Carroll case. That basically means it puts the decision into effect, right? He was found guilty of sexual assault. Under current New York state law, that would qualify as rape, but it was sexual assault in the pre-existing law, right? If he appeals, he's going to have 30 days to put $83.3 million in the bank in escrow on top of the 5.5 that he's already got there. Meanwhile, the Florida stolen documents case is moving forward, albeit slowly. A couple of things I want to say about this to make that sort of shift in the narrative.
Okay, these that's your foundation. Keep going.
Will require that he appear in court. He has as much as admitted this week that he's going to use the RNC, right, the political body of the Republican Party,
yes,
right, to fund his lawyers, not the election, right? So money and attention that would otherwise be devoted to the election campaign, right, he's going to be spending while he's sitting in court. Meanwhile, the Republican Party has demonstrated itself literally unable to govern even its own coalition in the House of Representatives, which could result in another government shutdown in March. Meanwhile, Biden administration has demonstrated itself really competent, even if they've not been good at communicating that. And people are still really angry about Dobbs. Given that context, why do we spend so much time wringing our hands about Biden being 4 years older than Trump and not focused on the really profound disadvantages that Trump faces going into this election?
Actually, I was thinking about the RNC and wanting to bring his daughter-in-law in. And basically, we know that he's going to use the RNC money as a slush fund to pay his legal bills. People think, well, that's terrible because the RNC would be willing to be funding congressional races and whatever. But let's be honest, there is so much billionaire dark money that I don't think it matters that the RNC's money is not going to be going to candidates. I just think there's so much money that's awash and it doesn't get rinsed through the RNC. And the reason I say that, and you know this as well as I do, Lincoln, that if you give money to the RNC, it's reported. But if you are a 501c4, or if you are a sort of dark money group or a super PAC, there's a lot of ways that you don't have to ever have your fingers attached to the money that you give. And that's the whole problem with it. We're all focusing on the money that we know about. What we don't know is the billions that will go in targeted races. And that is problematic, I think. Yes, the RNC is going to be helpful for Donald Trump for legal bills, but I almost think in some ways the parties matter less and less, because there's so much other money washing around that it becomes really a problem. But I do want to get back to the last point that you made, Stephen, and that is the question of Biden and his age, and we focus on it. And I really love the commentary. And here's the headline from Salon.com. Biden and Trump are both too old, but only one Lincoln is a traitor. And I do think that we have to constantly say, yes, they're both old. Yes, yes. We have to acknowledge it all the time. But just describe the fact that there's old and then there's traitor old. And we have to almost frame it that way so that the old almost loses its vigor and its venom and its idea that somehow you can't function, because one is traitor old and the other one is competent old. And there's clearly a difference, Lincoln.
Well, they're both old and only one is a fascist.
They're
both old and only one is a rapist. I want to thank Stephen for keeping track of all these court cases, because frankly, I can't. I know there's a lot out there, but it is difficult to keep track of it. So a couple of points with regards to all of this. First, the noise around Trump is always meant to make him seem more popular and powerful and strong than he is. And for whatever reason, much of the media buys into that. There is no question he's a weak general election candidate. Tim Scott or Nikki Haley would be up 12 points right now, right? Mm-hmm. Or so against Joe Biden, not in a primary. Winning essentially uncontested primaries is not a show of strength. And we've always known that all of these court cases will help him in the primary and hurt him in the general. And we have seen no evidence to suggest that's not true. We've also know that Joe Biden is too old, but so is Donald Trump. I think Donald Trump's, the kind of mental and psychological issues that Donald Trump faces are not age-related entirely. There's something else going on there, but he's a much further state of deterioration than Biden by pretty much any measure. I want to just make a couple notes here. The RNC is now formally captured by Donald Trump in a way right. That for many years it was informally captured by Donald Trump. What strikes me is that for the Trump campaign, the court cases is the campaign. This is not a campaign that will occur, you know, by going to give, he'll give us a few speeches and rallies, but by doing a press event, doing an interview, meeting with, you know, citizens in some community in a swing state. This is going to be cameras in the courtroom. That's their strategy.
Yes.
And that's because they're incapable of speaking to anyone beyond their base. So if you are so far down the MAGA Q rabbit hole that you believe that Biden is Putin, you know, in terms of this what's going on in the analogy to Navalny, then yes, you think all these court cases are good for Trump. But if you're living anything but the most tenuous of connections to reality, which is if you're living in the real world, you know that they're not. And you know, this dark money issue is massively important. Obviously, we've talked about this. I know that in my city of San Francisco, it's a huge issue. You know, the question of, can there be enough dark money, right? You know, I mean, even
how many billionaires do we create during the pandemic?
But it's,
I mean, I hate to
say
this, it's going to take a lot.
But the thing is this: if you are a conservative, super rich guy, you know, worth, let's say, at least $500 million in your values, your assets, you know, and you saw this, you saw the beginnings of this last week in Long Island, you know that Hakeem Jeffries is going to be the next Speaker of the House. And you know, because of that, that even if Trump wins, he's not going to be able to legislate and do anything. If you have that, if you're smart enough to be that much of a grifter that you've made all that money, now some of these people are heirs, as my father would say, they made their money the old-fashioned way, they inherited it. But are you really going to put $40 million, $200 million into this grift? I don't think so. I think that's tough. The way the Donald Trump grift works is by exploiting people who are scared, who are less educated, who are further down the MAGA rabbit hole. And part of his fundraising genius has been in $25 and $50 checks, and that's going to continue to go to the RNC, continue to go to Trump, and continue to be used for his legal cases. There will be dark money, and I think that dark money is going to be going to holding the Senate more than
oh, no, I'm not referring to the dark money going to the president race. I'm referring to the dark money going to the governor's races. I'm referring to the dark money going to the Senate races. That's what I'm referring to. And
that
all the, think about it. How many MAGA governors are there? 20, they're 25 of the 26. You know, only the governor of Vermont did not show up or sign a letter about the stupid border between Mexico and Texas. I mean, and then about 12 of them schlepped down there basically to flip the bird to the feds. This is where the dark money is going to go. Donald Trump is in a way genius because he doesn't need the money. You're absolutely right. I thought, David, I think what Lincoln was saying was absolutely those hearings are his campaign. That is his free media strategy. He doesn't need to buy ads. He just needs to show up at a hearing.
Well, why do you think he is showing up, Arnie, and not on the campaign trail? Why is he not having a Make America Great Again rally, and he's in New York, or he's here, or he's there? You know, that is the show, okay? That is the opportunity for him to go to the WWE wrestling ring WrestleMania situation of 2024 for him. Mind you, he is a 2013 inductee of the WWE Hall of Fame, if you have forgotten.
Of course.
That is the show right now. That is the main event. And Donald Trump's campaigning has really become secondary to him being able to send an email out to all of his supporters the moment that some twist or turn in the legal process happens and say, this is the latest thing in the witch hunt. This is the latest persecution of me, your beloved president. This is what you need to send your $50 in for, or $100. This is about you, because when they attack me, they attack you. It's the same playbook over and over again. But I actually want to bring up a quick point to just what we were talking about dark money. This may be an unpopular opinion, but nevertheless, I'll bring it up. I think that there's a good chance that Donald Trump actually could be hurt in a fairly significant way by the legacy of the Citizens United versus Federal Election Commission Supreme Court decision. And what we saw with Ron DeSantis was a little bit of a harbinger of this. He had a super PAC that raised insane amounts of money, and it didn't go really well for him at all because he didn't have direct control out of it. It kind of spiraled out of his control. I think that Donald Trump is going to get grifted by super PACs that come up raising money in his name. We've seen this in small doses, and I bet this is going to be a larger phenomenon as we go through the campaign season, where Donald Trump is not going to necessarily have full control of his messaging. And you're going to have groups that pop up, or people who want to Donald Trump, but actually hurt Donald Trump by having this just completely go haywire. His campaign and the RNC, that is what he does control. The rest of the stuff could get pretty hairy as Donald Trump's own effort in legal situation just continue to spiral out of control into whatever it becomes.
So before we sort of go to break, a couple of things have been popping in my head. One is we're talking about how Donald Trump basically is using these hearings and all this opportunity. That's his campaign strategy. This is what he needs to do. And the problem is, you know what this reminds me of? Remember all the free media Donald Trump got in 2016 from like CNN and whatever? I mean, he was able to do things that no other candidate was able to do. And what was it, over $1 billion, maybe $2 billion? Well, in a bizarre way, what's happening with these hearings is that it's also his free media strategy. He doesn't need to campaign. He just needs to show up in court, and then CNN, MSNBC, all of them cover it 24/7. And there he is in performance mode, not necessarily because it's going to aid and abet him legally, but it's going to aid and abet him with his base, which will then send another $25 check or another $50 check. So in a bizarre way, free media is once again providing Donald Trump with exactly what he wants. You know, all the focus is on him. Number two, Fannie Willis, in the hearing the other day, was also doing something interesting. She was in performance mode as well. Okay. She was using this opportunity, at least after lunch, to really sort of turn the tables on this and remind everyone who was really at trial. And she did things that nobody would ever recommend that someone would do in a courtroom, except she did it, which I thought was amazing. But she was in a lot of ways performing a little bit like Donald Trump, in the sense of recognizing that the cameras were on her, and here was her opportunity to basically get her message out and to remind everyone why she was there. So it's just so interesting how campaigns are now happening in courtrooms and not necessarily happening in places that we were used to. With that, let me go to a break. This is the Monday edition of The Attitude with Arnie Arneson, producers Dave Scott and Stephanie Collins. We call it Rethink the Week. We'll be rejoined by David Leventhal, Stephen Pimpare, and Lincoln Mitchell. Stick around, folks. We'll be right back.
When I was a little girl, a wolf hunted our family farm. It wasn't content to pick off a chicken or the family dog. It wanted the whole farm. My father found work, but the wolves found him. My parents always thought they'd catch a break, but they never did. The wolves came for mom and pop stores. They came for cheap prescription medicine. They came for affordable homes. They came for college loans. Forget inflation. Wages never kept up with corporate greed. So I went to school and scholarship. I became an agricultural engineer, fell in love, found a great job, started a family, had three kids, and invented two patents for Cargill and made them a killing. When the wolves came to reorganize the company, they found me too. Their first solution every time, cut jobs. Because to them, we're the problem. It's not their risky behaviors. It's not their bad investments. It's our livelihoods, our healthcare, our mortgages, our working class dreams. I'm Katrina Christensen. I'm running for U.S. Senate because Congress hasn't passed meaningful antitrust, pro-family legislation in almost 100 years. They abandoned family farms. They abandoned American manufacturing. They turned healthcare into a trillion-dollar industry. And they let Amazon and Walmart hunt family businesses to extinction. Wolves. And Congress hasn't culled the pack since Teddy Roosevelt was president. I'm an engineer, and I can tell you, problems like we're facing don't fix themselves. We gotta be tougher and smarter and more stubborn than the forces that are bankrupting the American middle class. My kids have no concept of the poverty I grew up with, the insecurity and shame. And as long as they're under my roof, they won't. And our senator should feel that way about us, should be protective of each of our children, our rights, our health, our land and water, our safety, our national security. Our senators shouldn't be afraid to face the wolves.
When it's 2019, but it feels like 1933. When your eyes are open, when you know the history. When your parents lived through things that looked so much like this, all the indications impossible to miss. When you've sought for your whole life to make the earth a better place, and you once again see the rising of the master race. When you know that they are coming, when they announced it in advance. When you know for many people this will be their last chance. Then you may ask the question, what can one person do when the time to act is now? And now it's up to you. When it's 2019, but it feels like 1933, when indefinite detention is the new reality for so many children to whom you did not give birth. When you see they're just as precious as every other child on earth. When they're opening the camps not used since the war, where families were imprisoned decades before. When Kristallnacht is coming, they announced it on the news. When the writing's on the wall, when you can see the fuse, then you may ask the question, what can one person do when the time to act is now? And now it's up to you. When
and it's 2019, but it feels like 1933. When you know rallies are not helping and silence is complicity. When you know where the kids are kept, locked inside their cells. When you see approaching the future this foretells. When they're coming for your neighbors, when they've even said what day they plan to put them all in buses and take them away. When you know where they keep the buses, you've been to the parking lot. Perhaps a whole lot of petrol bombs is the best move that you got. Then you may ask the question, what can one person do when the time to act is now? And now it's up to you. When it's 2019, but it feels like 1933.
Welcome back to part two of the Monday edition of The Attitude with Arnie Arneson and producers Dave Scott and Stephanie Collins. You know what we call it? We call it Rethink the Week, and we actually tape it on Friday morning. We're rejoined by Lincoln Mitchell from Columbia, Stephen Pimpere from the Carsey Institute, and Dave Leventhal, editor-in-chief of Raw Story. And I just got to go back to something because I want people to figure out how do we do messaging in this world where everyone's in their own silo, people are doing their Fox and their Newsmax or their MSNBC, and you know, you don't even have friends anymore. You think your friends are your Facebook friends. Friends and you don't even know who they look like. I want to use what's old and bring it back, because one of the things we were talking about was Biden's age. And I really do love the Salon article, Biden and Trump are both too old, but one is a traitor. And I want to make a suggestion to people in the party, and frankly, it doesn't need to be people in the party. If you just like the idea, do it in your freaking town. And what I suggest is do the old Bermashave ads. Put those ads up literally on every main thoroughfare. And if you remember the Bermashave ads, you walk down the street or drove down the street and there'd be one ad and then another ad and then another ad. And they actually told the story, okay? So you have to keep following, looking for the next sign. What's the next sign going to say? And I think what the Democrats should be doing, or people should be doing, is doing the comparison. Yes, right. They're both old. But one is traitor old and the other guy is old. One is rapist old, the other guy is, and just think about what it is and think about how you label Donald Trump. One is a liar old and the other one is, you know, and you can just do it. And if you do a series of Bermashave ads and they start cropping up all over the country, then guess what? The word old loses its meaning, but traitor doesn't. Rapist doesn't. Liar doesn't. You know, all these things that need to really be attached to Donald Trump, and we need to remind people, and what a great way to remind them, using a Bermashave ad. But with that, let me turn to Stephen Pimpere, because you also wanted to sort of challenge me on the fact that I thought that Donald Trump was kind of being brilliant in the same way he did in 2015 and 2016, where he had this incredible free media strategy, and CNN and CBS and all these stations gave him all this free media time worth billions, and he didn't have to do what other people had to do. They didn't have to show up on the set. They didn't have to have a conversation. They could basically sort of mail it in. But ultimately what they did was they gave him just this incredible opportunity to once again at no cost be in everyone's living room. And to a large extent, Mr. Pimpere, he's doing the same thing. He's now, you know, at no cost. Well, maybe, I mean, 83 million, maybe it cost, but he's like appearing in people's living rooms again. And the story is all Trump all the time. And at least if nothing else for his base, it just is his example of this is why you need to elect me because I will be your revenge. But you want to push back. Pimpere.
Well, so first of all, base only gets you so far in a general election. But I think there's a crucial difference between, you know, saturation wall-to-wall media coverage in 2016 and what would likely be the case if one of these criminal cases goes to trial. And that is, in 2016, that wall-to-wall coverage, and there were credible estimates that the value of that was somewhere in the neighborhood of $2 billion with a B dollars in free media coverage, right? Is that every time he stood up and said words out loud, there was a camera on him, saturation coverage across all of the networks, and he was controlling the narrative, he was controlling the story. By contrast, right, if he is sitting as a criminal defendant in a courtroom with a judge who has the capacity to manage that courtroom effectively, not an easy thing if you've got someone like Donald Trump sitting in the courtroom, he is going to be sitting there passive as a criminal defendant. And a lot of this is not going to be televised, right? And where it is televised, the camera is not likely to be on him. It is likely to be on who is ever giving testimony at that moment. That is time that he is not spending on the campaign trail, giving speeches, dialing into Fox, doing all the ordinary things of a campaign. I do not think it ultimately is likely to work to his advantage.
And you wanted to touch on Fannie Willis because you were able to watch that whole day. I was only able to watch about an hour.
I don't know what I'm atoning for, but I'm atoning for something. Evidently, I watched a good chunk of Nathan Wade's testimony and all of Fannie Willis's testimony. And two things, one about the substance and one about sort of your observation about the performative nature of it. Remember, the accusation here, such as it is that she and Nathan Wade had a romantic relationship before she hired him. She then hired him at a higher salary than people say he merits. And because he's taken her out to dinner and taken her on vacations, she has benefited from that. And therefore, it is a corrupt relationship.
Well, and that you can't prove it because she paid with cash.
Correct.
I mean, the cash was, I mean, I, when she said,
well,
she
so
was-
here's that was one of the things that I was skeptical
about before. Yeah.
Is that here's the explanation. And by the way, there is no affirmative evidence other than one person who used to work with her who is no longer a friend, right? So always a dupe. That is the only witness to offer anything that amounts to evidence for these claims. I think it's really important to keep that in mind, right? Mm-hmm. But her explanation is that her dad always taught her as a woman and as a Black woman that you always need to be prepared and you always need to keep significant amounts of cash in your house for your own security and your own safety. And any number of times she said, you know, my daddy wouldn't be happy because I probably don't keep enough around that he thinks I should. And that amount varies, she says, over time, but is as much as $15,000 cash in her, wherever she lays her head at night. And hearing her talk about, right? I mean, think about the generations here, right? Her dad is 80, right? Is a Black man in the South. She is, I don't know how, she's 50 something, right? So a Black woman of a certain age in the South. You can see how he would see a world in such a way that he wants his daughter to be doing everything within her control to ensure whatever safety and security she can. And that also, by the way, going back to where you opened, means never being dependent upon a man, always making sure. Now, I thought, as someone who walked in, that was one of the things that I thought, this is weird that there are no records for any of these repayments. It's like it was all in cash. And that explanation to me, I mean, a middle-aged white guy in the North, that explanation to me was really persuasive, I must say.
I'm older than Fannie, but the same story was true when I was being raised, in the sense that I wasn't told to keep, you know, thousands of dollars in the house. I was told to keep hundreds of dollars in my pocket, that if I was going somewhere, especially where, you know, I mean, again, the idea was I needed a moat of safety around me. And the moat of safety was in cash, not in a check, not in whatever, because it meant that I could be on my own. I could protect myself. You don't need a Glock in your purse. You needed a $100 bill in your purse. Okay. That's ultimately what I mean. My girlfriend had a Glock in her purse. That was how she kept herself safe. I thought she was friggin' nuts. I'm like, you'll only get shot. You know, you'll drop your purse and you'll shoot yourself. At least with this money, I can flee. You know, and that is in some ways that is just, it's not uncommon. I was so uncomfortable because this isn't about her. This, you know what this reminded me of? About Bill Clinton and Monica Lewinsky. It was like, oh God, you're president of the United States. Couldn't you keep it in your pants? And what I was upset about with Fannie Willis is, oh my God, you want to take Donald Trump to court, to justice. You know, what are you doing? Wasn't there any other attorney you could hire? This is Bill Clinton, only he's got more cover than a Black woman, okay? Because he's a white guy with a lot more power. And yet, and I keep thinking, Fannie, call me. Don't do this. Fannie, call me. I'm not your friend. And maybe that's a good thing because I'll tell you the damn truth. And it's not that I want women to be more pure than men. I'm as equally angry at Clinton as I was at Fannie. Like, what were you thinking? And I just have to say that because it just gets me so upset because this is not a trial which is about her. This is a trial about justice and about us. It is about us. And you would have fiduciary responsibility to us to think about your behavior, because every single action that you take will be taken either out of context, distorted, and you gave them too much ammunition. You just did, especially because it was a Black woman. All right. I mean, we take our victims as we find them. And unfortunately, this is part of the problem. Anyway, let me go to Dave Leventhal. So, Dave, what is so interesting is we talk about old and old. And, you know, one is traitor old, one is rapist old, one is liar old. I love the way Donald Trump has done something that I've actually said out loud. And maybe he heard me explain it because he's now using it. Trump was explaining memory issues. I've actually said this out loud on my radio show. He goes, I interpose. Trump makes another gaffe. As he insists, his Haley-Pelosi mix-up was intentional. It's very hard to be sarcastic when I interpose, Trump complained. And I think he doesn't just interpose. I think he thinks all women are alike. I think he thinks that he wants to be running against Barack Obama and no Joe Biden because Barack Obama is a black guy and Joe Biden is an old white guy. So a lot of times his audience isn't necessarily either sophisticated or care, but they know who they need to hate. Because Donald Trump has taught them. And they know that they hate Pelosi more than they hate Haley. And they know that they hate Barack more than they hate Biden. So he does this. And people think it's his mind that's going. Maybe it's our ability to follow what he's doing, Dave Leventhal.
Well, of course, he's going to try to play it off. But I agree with you. I had sort of Nancy Pelosi, Nikki Haley, Marla Maples, E. Jean Carroll. They're all the same. And
exactly.
So, but that's an attitude. Okay. That's a front. That's a persona. And it's also a political technique of a sort when in the moment on the campaign trail, when Donald Trump is trying to get everyone all excited and in a lather and all worked up, plays pretty darn well. And are there downsides to it? Well, not really with the people who like Donald Trump. You know, that's an applause line. That's not something that is going to cause people to question Donald Trump's ability to think through a problem or make them think deep thoughts about whether Donald Trump has the mental acuity to serve as president of the United States for four more years. And we've seen this before. We will see this again. This is nothing new. It's just the latest in a string of things that Donald Trump has done that is causing many Americans to be aghast, but other Americans to just kind of delight in the chaos of it all.
We've been talking about TV, and we've been talking about trials and hearings. I want to talk a little bit about the Mayorkas impeachment, because I saw that Speaker Johnson has named Marjorie Taylor Greene and Clay Higgins to serve as impeachment managers to prosecute Mayorkas in Senate. And I wrote, oh my God, this is going to be must-see TV. And I'm wondering that, did Johnson actually do Biden a favor by putting Marjorie Taylor Greene in charge of this impeachment as an impeachment manager? I know he needs to genuflect and kiss her ring or kiss some other part of her body parts, but this is like, is this a good strategy? I mean, I think it's dead on arrival anyway in the Senate, but giving Marjorie Taylor Greene any more of a platform as it relates to this, I think only does damage to the hypocrisy of the Republicans on this whole issue of the border. And I think we'll all be tuned in, but not for a good reason when it comes to what the Republicans are trying to accomplish.
Well, that too is a strategy. And
yes,
we've gone in the Republican Party from her being more or less an outcast to somebody now who is who's sending fundraising messages on behalf of the National Party and who's been given positions of power and who's now serving in this capacity. So the Ringling Brothers, Barnum and Bailey aspect of this is a feature, not a bug.
All right, Lincoln Mitchell, do we talk a little bit at all about what's going on with what happened with the Kansas City Chiefs and guns? I feel like every time there is a shooting, every time we see an Uvalde or we see a July 4th celebration or we see what's happening, I feel like I almost want to make the GOP an accomplice. Because not only do they do the bidding of the NRA, then you see what happens at the state level and basically, you know, almost anything that can walk can have a gun. We're learning about the fact, I don't know if we've learned yet how old these people were that had this shootout at the Kansas City Chiefs parade. But I'm hearing that they were in their teens, maybe 17 or 18 or 19. Again, they had access to guns. And more importantly, I go back to the Uvalde shooting. What do we know about the Uvalde shooting? The shooter had begged his relatives when he was 17 to let him have a gun. As soon as he turned 18, he was able to buy a gun. And what did he do? Despite the fact that there were almost 100 law officers outside the door, how many children did he kill? And how do we kill? How do we kill? How do we connect what is happening with guns to Republicans? Because it's not about the gun industry. It's about the Republicans that do the gun industry's bidding.
Before I respond to that, I wanted to just touch on a couple things. I'm really fascinated by your comment, re-quoting Donald Trump, where he says he interposed Haley and Pelosi. That's not what the word interpose means.
Oh, yes.
It is worth noting that Trump rarely uses big words because he does have the best words. Maybe he just doesn't know how to use them. That's not, interpose does not mean replace. And it is striking that he would just repeat this word. He probably heard it 5 minutes ago and thought it was cool, but he gets the meaning completely wrong. I feel compelled to
let
go
me remind
back
everyone, interpose means to insert between one thing and another.
Right.
And
I interposed myself between the two arguing people.
Yeah,
what it means. I have to go back to Fani Willis because I feel it is remiss not to really focus on the deep racism and sexism of what we saw there. The subtext of all of this from the prosecution and in MAGA world is, how can a black woman have this much power?
Yes.
Full stop. Fani Willis isn't some randomly selected black woman off the street. She is the district attorney. First of all, even if she were some randomly selected black woman off the street, the racism and sexism would still be clear. Her father, who told her to keep cash in, you know, around her, also raised a daughter who went to college and graduated from law school and won an election. The man involved here is a lawyer. It is an African-American lawyer who actually has a background that is appropriate to this case. And yes, at the end of the day, it's an unforced error.
Yes.
But not a lot of lawyers, if you're Fani Willis in Georgia, that you can completely trust on something like this. But the subtext here is, who are you to be a lawyer, to be a district attorney, Ms. African-American woman? That's not the language they would use. That's the language I'm using. Who are you, Mr. African-American man, to be a prominent attorney with special skills relevant to the prosecution of our criminal cult leader? And the deep, deep history on this country, going back to when the first slave ships disembarked in 1619 and took their passengers, took the slaves off, not passengers, they were treated like cargo, of trying to control the sexuality and the bodies of African-American women. This continues to this day, and we saw that there. And now I want to touch on the shooting, because I had to get that in my system. You know, I just want to say this. The language that we use to describe these terrible events is wrong. Okay. A mass shooting did not occur. A shooter didn't. I mean, we say this. A mass shooting occurred in Kansas City. At the Super Bowl parade, somebody shot, injured over 20 and killed somebody. No, the Republican Party facilitated another mass shooting.
Yes.
The Republican Party contributed to the death of one and the injuries of 20, and let's hope they all recover, you know, and they get better. We have to talk about it in that language. These people die and these shootings occur because the Republican Party wants them to.
I don't understand why it has taken us so long to get to that language. It has been so obvious, you know, since Sandy Hook. It's been so obvious, and yet we're somehow, what is the level of intimidation? What is the point? And just in my state, for example, there are 20 states that have red flag laws. Well, New Hampshire just tried to pass a red flag law, Lincoln, and of course it went down in the state Senate, all right? And, you know, and we have one of the weakest gun laws probably in the country. We also have Sturm Ruger. That's one of the biggest beneficiaries in my state because we just give them, like, you know, bond benefits to expand their facility here. But red flag laws, I mean, this is at least the minimum they can do. And once again, I'm going to tell you, Stephen Pimpare, I just basically call them their accomplices. You know, they're absolutely accomplices because these are people that know the individual that has a gun, and they are so terrified because they know that they could either commit suicide or they could kill one of them, you know, and yet in just whatever extent, they're not allowed to take their guns away. So when the person is dead, it's too late, Stephen. Oh, God.
So as is often the case, I think the answer to the question is to how does this wind up happening when we know that overwhelming majorities of all people in the country favor stricter controls on access to weapons of mass death? The answer is our broken institutions, right? We've got a Senate That is desperately malapportioned, and in which a majority of the population dictates laws that govern the majority, and that malapportionment in the Senate disproportionately favors white, rural, gun-owning people, right? Yeah. Because, you know, big rural states get the same representation as California and New York, right? That's part of it. Part of it is to use the formal language, if Lincoln will the Fakakta Supreme Court, that in the Heller decision, I forget what year that was, very recently, invented a new reading of the Second Amendment to say, no, that whole militia stuff in the Second Amendment, nope, ignore it, not there. Everybody has an individual right to own guns. And there is a case that they have heard this term, right? That my listening to, again, for more atoning, their oral arguments suggests that they are going to say that states do not have the ability to restrict even people who have been convicted of domestic violence offenses from being forbidden to have guns, right? If you want public policy in the United States to better reflect overall opinion and not to mention our health and well-being, right? Yes, vote in large numbers, vote early, vote often, but also start thinking about fundamental structural reforms to the system so that majorities actually can achieve what it is that we would like to achieve for all of us.
So Dave Leventhal, you know how they say that, you know, we're the place where you're supposed to be able to experience life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness, right? And so after the Kansas City Chiefs shooting, I wrote, the goal of these kinds of shootings, whether it's intentional or in this case, it was. I mean, they knew that there were a million people there. They knew that there was density. They were packing heat. I wrote that in a lot of ways, what has happened now is that they've now learned how to destroy joy. Okay? Because murder is their tool. There's no joy now except fear about sending your kid to school. There's no joy now in going to a parade to celebrate the Kansas City Chiefs because, God forbid, you don't know the person standing next to you might be packing heat. There's no joy in going to a July 4th parade because there could be a mass murder at a July 4th. Look what they have done. They've made every setting, Dave Leventhal, a place where you have to think twice. That doesn't happen anywhere else probably in the world. It doesn't happen in China. Of course, nothing much happens because they're so controlled. But it doesn't. My daughter is saying, how do people live here? How do they live here with the insecurity? How do they live here with this constant fear? How do they live here looking at maybe the person standing next to you going, what's that bulge in your pocket? You know, it's not a wad of Kleenex. This is nuts. And it's not just in rural areas now because it was in Kansas City. That's not rural. But the joy was there and it was taken away, Dave. I can't believe we can't figure out a way to not only run on this and then affect policy, because now it is touching so many of us that we might be in our second mass shooting, not just our first.
And we don't have enough time to delve into the details of this, but we have a system in this country where all 50 states have different gun laws. Simple as that. Yeah. So what the deal is in Missouri is different than what the deal is going to be in New Hampshire or New York or New Mexico or anywhere else in the country. So it becomes a question of, is the federal government going to do anything about this on a national level? The answer simply is no, they're not in a meaningful way. Yes, we had the one bill and law that got passed in about, what, a year and a half ago's time. But that was a tiny little tick in what is obviously just a monumental and massive and some would argue even existential problem. But until something happens at the national level, we can expect that you're going to have many states in this country for years to come that simply view this as a cost of doing business and preserving Second Amendment rights. Simple as that.
But you live in Washington, D.C., and Washington, D.C. has a real crime problem.
Sure,
okay?
Do.
I think Republicans love it because they get to use Washington, D.C. as their poster child for the rest of the country, as if it is, and it's not, because violent crime has actually gone down almost everywhere else, except for maybe in D.C. But in a lot of ways, that's another reason why the idea of guns flowing into D.C., even though they have strict gun laws, all these things. I mean, the border is porous. There is no, I mean, so what if it's one way in one state or one way in another? It doesn't matter without the federal government stepping in.
Well, I am looking across the street into Maryland, literally as we speak. So yes, borders are very porous, and also
state,
the gun
state
laws
lines
in Washington,
are porous.
D.C.
State lines.
We're talking about state lines, not borders.
Yeah, yeah. Well, that's the border between states. Pardon my expression.
And,
yes.
And, you know, we're gun laws are not what they used to be in Washington, D.C. and in other places around the country, too.
I have to thank you guys for doing this. It's the end of the Monday edition of The Attitude with Arnie Arneson and producers Dave Scott and Stephanie Collins. You know what we call it? We call it Rethink the Week. We've been joined by Stephen Pepere, a senior fellow at the Carsey School of Public Policy at the University of New Hampshire, Dave Leventhal, who leads Raw Stories Newsroom as an editor-in-chief and oversees its investigations and enterprise reporting, and Lincoln Mitchell, who teaches political science and public policy at Columbia University. If you want to read more of Lincoln, you can go to his Substack, Kibitzing with Lincoln. Thank you, gentlemen, so much for doing this. I really appreciate it. Ciao. All right, everyone, we will schmooze tomorrow. This is The Attitude. You may-